Welcome, everybody, to part I've lost track already, 36, I believe, of the fascinating series. And we want to thank the Solbachs. That's how this whole conversation began. We want to thank them, Jules and Carl and Carlos Solbach, for sponsoring this evening's lecture in memory of their parents, Yaakov ben Hachaver, Rabbi Yitzchak, and Chana bat Yosef. And the Shamot should have an aliyah we should have to celebrate happy occasions. So thank you very much. And Dr. Shapiro, it's all yours.
Okay. Hello, everyone. Welcome again, especially for those of us in the New York area living through the biggest snowstorm we've had in many years. I want to begin. Unfortunately, we lost three more important people this week. If you're not aware of it, I'll share it with you. I'll say something about each one. The first is they called him Rav David, Rav Shulam David Soloveitchik, the son of Rav Elvel. Really, the last person born in Brisk who would have remembered the Torah world of Brisk. Obviously, someone who carried on the Brisker dynasty, the Brisker method. Let me say one interesting point about him, though, because if you know a bit about Brisk, you'll know that. He was very extreme and a big anti-Zionist, all sorts of extreme stuff. But he's not Satmar. And what I mean by this is as follows. The psul, in my opinion, of Satmar isn't the anti-Zionism. I mean, that's people, there's freedom of thought if they want to be anti-Zionist. Of course, I don't like it if they are ally with non-Jews against Israel, but usually they don't. But I'm not such a Mizrahi person that it bothers me so much if Satmar wants to be anti-Zionist. What bothers me is, and I think is the real psul, is that they degrade Torah scholars that are not in their camp. And we saw the tshuvot of Rabbi Avi Nehra of Yehuda Hotzenken about this. That was never a trait in the Soloveitchik family. In fact, you can look in, if you're just interested, you can go to Shirei of Rav Meshulam David Soloveitchik, Drushva Gadai, found one of the volumes in which after pages of blasting Zionism, how terrible it is. And if you think that he thinks Zionism destroys the hope for Mashiach, if you think there's anything positive in the state of Israel, you have a problem, real extremist stuff. But then he says, and listen carefully to this, he says, everything we said, this is after all the pages about how Zionism is the worst possible thing. He says, Zehu al Hashita. He says, this is referring to the idea, the lozalzel ba'anashim charedim afil im toim ashkavatam lelech achrehem, and he explains that we're not talking about individuals. And if you have Orthodox Jews who make a mistake and who follow Zionism, asur, he says, it's forbidden to degrade a Talmud Chacham, and you have to tzarich lizaher b'chavod haTorah v'lisnahegim am b'derech eretz. And he goes on that this is, he says, in all the years I never heard my father degrade anyone. And also Reb Chaim never would degrade anyone. We know Reb Chaim Dafko went to the funeral of Shmuel Moliver to let people know that the dispute was only an ideological dispute. Shmuel Moliver, the early Zionist, was Zionist, but also he's a good old Yisrael, to know that the dispute was only ideological. And this is a trait. Even Rav Kook is respected by the Soloveitchiks. So it's, although philosophically they are no different than, I shouldn't say they're no different than Satmar, because their opposition to Zionism is not because of the Gimel Shavuos, the three Shavuos. It's because of the heretical nature of secular Zionism, and also they thought that establishing a state would lead to mass deaths of Jews in the war. But in practice, they're the same as Satmar and the Troikart and the rest. They do not believe there should be a state. There shouldn't have been a state. They think Zionism is demonic, basically. It's a way of turning Jews into irreligious, like the Goyim. But in terms of how you deal with people who are Zionists, so we know that in Satmar, they degrade routinely, not just Zionist rabbis. They would degrade Rabbi Steinman, all sorts. Their chinuch is unfortunately all about degrading people who disagree with them. It's an unbelievable sort of backwards type of education. But among the Briskers, it's not that way. It's the Shita, only the Shita, and look, they're entitled to have that view. In fact, this is a famous story that Rav Elvel was very friendly with Rav Meir Bar Ilan. So one then nearby line, that's his relative was once visiting him. So someone, one of the extremists says, why are you so friendly with him? He's a Zionist. So he said he's mishpacha. He's family. So for family, that goes for the Briskers above all ideological conflicts. So someone else, another rabbi was there, said, well, then we should feel the same thing with Rav Kook. He thinks that all of Kol Yisrael is his family. So why do we criticize Rav Kook for reaching out to the irreligious? These, in his mind, they're all family. So that's, he's 99 years old. So, but you know, at that age, when you get the virus, it's tough. The next person who we lost this week, the same day actually, is Rabbi Shiner, Rav Yitzhak Shiner. He's the Rosh Yeshiva, the Kamenetz Yeshiva. He's born in America, Pittsburgh. He was he learned in YU, or in those days it was called Yeshiva College. He was Yitzhak Hanan. And then he went to Torah Vadas. It says here, he taught in Montreux, Switzerland in the 60s. He was a Rebbe, became close to Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg. And then he became head of the Kamenetz Yeshiva. In fact, here I'll show you a tidbit for those here. Oops, sorry. I got to share this with you. Let me show you here. This comes from Hamasmid, which was in 1940, the Yeshiva College magazine, or not magazine, yearbook. And here it has a picture of the chess team. And let me enlarge it for you a little bit. And who's on the chess team? None other than Isidore Shiner. Isidore Shiner is none other than Rabbi Yitzhak Shiner. The problem is I don't know which one of these. The picture's not that clear. I'm not sure which one is Rabbi Shiner. I guess I could figure it out if I enlarged it enough. But he was on the chess team. And big Rosh Yeshiva, big Talmud Chacham. So that's unfortunate. And finally, the last one we lost, and we mentioned him last week that he was ill, is Rabbi Abraham Tversky. Therapist, big Talmud Chacham. Just so you remember one thing, Rabbi Dr. Abraham Tversky invented something that we all know well. So let me just play it for you.
In 1960, it was the week before my younger brother married, and I was davening, and I remember the spot that I was at in the shul. And I was davening Shachris Hoidu, and I came to the phrase, Hoshia as Hamecho, right? We ask Hashem, save your, help your people, and bless your inheritance, and elevate them into eternity. And as I was saying that, I started thinking to myself, Hoshia as Hamecho. Next week, the week after that, my younger brother got married, so I sang it at his wedding, and it caught on. And some people who were at the wedding went to Israel, and they brought the song to Israel. And a few weeks later, a new tune came from Israel. And this was the tune. It was a Braslev, a song of the Braslev Hasidim. I said, okay. Then later I heard, it's a Chabad song. Okay, what do I care? I can't copyright it anyway. Right. So
that's Hoshia, the song we all know, that's from Abraham Tversky, but that's not why he's important. He's important for all he did in terms of addictions and all sorts of psychotherapy and Judaism. So another big loss. A couple other things. I've been having conversations with the RCA Siddur. They needed to know, they're trying to figure out now what to do in terms of a vice president who's a woman. How do you call her? And we say, Nasiv Es Mishnehu, what should we do? So in Israel, apparently, Sagan is used. And I learned that for vice president, the word is Saganit. Remember, not so that we had this discussion about the, this Yud Tuf ending. So even though I originally assumed it's a strange ending, that's what it is. Two more things. Rav Aryeh Leib from Eretz Yisrael writes, we saw Rabbi Katz's past thing about violating Shabbos if you're under addiction. He just wants to stress that experience has shown that alcohol and drug addictions are not like other addictions, that once you if you fall back, it could really lead you down really a terrible slippery slope. So it's really different than the other case we were speaking about. Robert says, we spoke about the Koizumberger Rebbe's hatred of non-Jews. And I raised the issue that, we have these rabbis that we don't want to disown them. I just raised in my mind the question of Farrakhan, that we have a problem where, in the Black community, they don't want to disown him. And I raised the issue that, I see where they're coming from, because we sometimes could also have the problem. Rabbi Victor Miller, for instance, I mean, some of the stuff he says is outrageous, really, really racist stuff. Does that mean we just get rid of him? But Robert writes that Farrakhan's different because he used to be a fringe character, but now, he's recognized by the leadership of the Women's March and several Congress people. It's a different ballgame. Look, obviously, I wish Farrakhan would be gone. He's all trouble, evil man. But that's not what I was talking about. What I was talking about was the issue that, for instance, that Black politicians just seem to be connected. This picture, incidentally, never came out during the election. A Black photographer took it and wouldn't publish the picture till after Obama was no longer in office because he thought that would doom his presidency. It's the only point I was trying to make is that I see from the Black perspective that they like so many of the things he says that they often find it hard for them to condemn him completely, even though I'd like them to. I wish they would. But all I was saying is that I get it to a certain degree because we have that problem as well. And one of the rabbis in my book, Rav Dov Lior, someone wrote to me saying it was a disgrace that I included a letter from him because he's a racist, they say. And, I don't know where to draw the line. Two more things. I gave you my spiel last time that I think that the Hasidim, that what they're doing, it's like a form of Reform Judaism, not caring about Chil Hashem, not caring about the halachas of Pikuach Nefesh. And then I said, the fact that they're strict in all these areas, so what? The Sadducees were strict. The Karaites were stricter sometimes more than the rabbis. And lo and behold, in Rabbi Mazuz's Parsha sheet last week, he cites an example of the Karaites. I mean, I knew the example, but I'll show you. He speaks about this example that it's in Vayikra. What are we here? Chapter 3. If you look in this pasuk, verse 9, where it talks about chelbo ha'aliyah, which we translate the choice part of the tale, but the Karaites understood this as like connected to chelev. That's and they connected just like you can't eat the chelev, you can't eat the tail. Whereas we think you can eat the tail. So there's an example where the Karaites were stricter than us. Look, there's an old joke, which they say, why do we say in, Roshon Zalman Arbach actually said this, why does it say in Davening Al Tzadikim V'al Chassidim, why do we put Tzadikim before Chassidim? Because you don't start up with Chassidim. You know, in Matchilim B'Chassidim. So I don't want to start up with them. That's my opinion. Okay, then the last thing I want to say before we begin, and we have lots of good stuff, is, this is a pretty unique class in that we have people who are not in the Orthodox world who listen to it on YouTube. I don't know if live. We have people non-Orthodox. We have people right-wing. We have Hasidim. We have Satmar. We have... So a lot of people know things about certain things. They don't know things about other things. So let me just take 2 minutes because someone emails me and asking a question about, because we dealt earlier classes about Kol Isha. And what I'm going to tell you now might be shocking for some of them, but I'm not the rabbi here. I'm not going to defend, you can ask your local rabbis. I'm just telling you how it is. In the modern Orthodox world, Kol Isha is not taken the way it is in the Haredi world. You can see, for instance, most recently, Rav Moshe Lichtenstein has a whole piece on this. I'll just read you his conclusion. He wrote in Hebrew and English that he says, we may summarize as follows. Under circumstances in which the song does not arouse sexual desire, does not emphasize femininity in a sensual manner, and the listener estimates that he will not come to have sexual thoughts, we should not forbid listening to a woman's voice. So it's all based on individual feelings. And then he says, this means that Zmiro's not a problem, participation in official ceremonies. You can hear a woman do a Star Spangled Banner or anything you know, it's up to you individually. So that's what he says. Now, the fact is that as far as I know, every single modern Orthodox school in America has girls singing, usually singing in groups, sometimes, at least as of a couple of years ago, Ramaz, Yeshiva of North Shore, women, girls solos as well. Furthermore, it goes more than this. I'm going to show you something right now, which will be astounding. It's not just, and it's not even a Sridi Ashes Heter, because we're not dealing with holy songs. You have a yeshiva competition, Battle of the Bands in the New York area. Of all the yeshivas, modern Orthodox yeshivas, even the more right wings participate. Masifta of Waterbury participates, and girls sing. So I'm going to show you something. If it troubles you, you can turn away or something, but I'll just show you quickly so you know what I'm talking about. And I'm doing this for you in the Haredi world to listen, because I know you're going to be astounded by this. And again, I'm not here to defend or anything. I'm just saying this is what it is. I'm going to show you Maya Note, who were second place. And this is, in the modern Orthodox world, this is not surprising, but here. These are girls from Maya Note, which is a separate sex school in Bergen County that we already said it should be Maya Note, but they call it Maya Note. So just watch this for a second and understand this is this, and this takes place every year when you could have yeshiva competition. And this is for boys and girls.
Some nights I stay up, cashing in my bad luck. Some nights I call it a draw. Some nights I...
And it's real performance. Like, look.
Still not sure and for what's up. Oh, this is war. What are you waiting for? Why don't we break the rules already? I was never one to believe the hype.
So obviously this would never happen in a Haredi, and you think this is crazy. But by the way, I think even the boys singing is crazy, because why should a yeshiva, you could say, I mean, sing secular songs like this? Masifta of Waterbury did Jewish songs. I'll give you an example. These are the guys who won first place.
Whoa.
So this is not unusual for anyone who lives in the New York area, knows the modern Orthodox schools. And I'm just giving this because the question I was asked about girls singing, it's like so far out of left field without any understanding of what actually takes place in the modern Orthodox that you can actually have events where girls, granted, are singing together, but still are actually performing and running around on the stage. And that's I'm sure you have that in Israel also in the religious Zionists, but let me leave that at there. Okay, everyone, let us return to where we were. We're getting into the Rambam again. I'm going to show you some interesting things. I do want to actually correct something I said last class when I said that the Rambam, because this is going to be relevant to what we're going to do today as well. I said he doesn't have a problem with someone thinking God has emotions. I shouldn't have used that language. Of course he has a problem, because you're not supposed to think God has emotions. What I meant is that he doesn't regard you as a heretic. It's not one of the 13 principles, anything like that. So he can be he's a little laid back. And if people make the mistake and they don't, the Rambam in a number of places is willing to allow the masses, even if it's wrong, to carry on with mistaken ideas. So for instance, one of the most famous examples of this is as follows. What does the Rambam say? in the Mishnah Torah, Hilchos Mezuzah, which chapter 4, he says, Halacha 4, it's a common custom to write God's name, Shaddai, on the outside of Mezuzah, opposite the empty space left between the two passages. There's no difficulty in this, since the addition is made outside. Those, however, who write the names of angels, sacred names, etc., on the inside of the mezuzah, have no share in the world to come, because they nullify the mitzvah. They turn the mitzvah into a kameya, a talisman. The Rambam thinks it's foolish, it's meaningless to write God's name on the outside also, but you're not affecting the mitzvah. There's nothing about the mitzvah. You're just doing something foolish. So if people want to do something foolish, that's okay. But when you actually, on the inside, next in the cloth, where the Hebrew writing is, if you're going to write God's special holy names and angels' names there, then you're getting involved in the mitzvah. And that has to be uprooted. That's incorrect. So the Rambam's tolerant. I said this to a friend of mine, because a friend of mine, a very learned guy in Teaneck, he might listen to some of the classes, he wrote a letter to the Jewish Link last year, because the Jewish Link publishes the most crazy stuff sometimes. Actually, it was 2 years ago. You have people coming to read palms. Once someone came bring holy water, you know, Jews have holy water too. And you have these Kabbalists, these self-styled Kabbalists that you can call and meet them. It's like they take out these big ads that Rabbi so-and-so will be meeting people. You have a woman who comes and she has this molten lid. She does hocus pocus to remove the eye in horror. And he writes an article saying there that this is an outrage and this is a chil Hashem and it's a disgrace. And I wrote to him, I said, the Rambam is more tolerant, that if people feel they get something from it, the Rambam is willing to let it slide, as long as it's not, you're not taking the mitzvah itself and using it as an amulet. If people want to have their gatherings where they, all these sort of things they do, their challah baking and all that for the to get rid of the ayin haras, the Rambam's okay with all of that. Now, this is going to be very relevant to what we're going to see now, because we're going to see something where the Rambam is not so tolerant of. And before we get into that, I need to show you a halacha in the Rambam. The Rambam says as follows. There actually is, it's a rare book now. It's very hard to find, but it's a... there's a translation of Sefer Mada of the Rambam, together with the commentary, the criticisms of the Rivad, and a little bit of a commentary by the translator. The translator's name is Rabbi Simon Glazer. He was a rabbi in a number of places in America. Also was a rabbi earlier in Canada, in Montreal. I believe it was not Toronto. I think it was Montreal. In one of Ira Robinson's books about the rabbis in Montreal, he deals with him and the Kashrus controversies he was involved in. Incidentally, Ira Robinson has a new book coming out on none other than Rabbi Yudel Rosenberg, the famous golem, Yudel Rosenberg, and who was the rabbi of the shul, I guess, that Rabbi Kelman used to be the rabbi of. But so this is that if you've never seen the translation, here it is. So this is in Perek Gimel, Halacha Zion. Let me read it to you here in Hebrew and translate. He says, Chamisha Heman Igraim Minim. There's five people are called Minim. Now the translator has atheists here. Atheist is not really the translation. Heretics, I would say. HaOmer, one who says, Shein Sham Eloa, as we said, it's pronounced, is not pronounced Eloha. It's not pronounced, we spoke about this, I think. It's called the furtive patach, or patach genuva. We have that, there's different ways of pronouncing it. In the Sephardic world, they pronounce it generally not Eloa, it's Eloa. Also, for example, you have how do you pronounce it? Say, Yareach. Is it Yareach? Or is it Yareach with a yud? Different, but everyone knows you don't pronounce it Eloha. It's like the word Noach; it goes beforehand. And incidentally, the word Sham there, Haomer Shein Sham, Eloha. The word Sham, there's so much written about it. What does it mean? People don't know what to make it. It's simply an Arabic word that's been brought into Hebrew. You can't translate it. It's so one who says there is no God, there's no ruler, I guess, of the world. That's a heretic. The second one is there is a ruler, Yesha Manhig of Alhen Shnayim El Yoser. There's more than one God. Now, this is the one we're interested in, the third one. Va'omer sheyesham ribon echad, someone who says that there is one God, aval shuguf ubal tmuna, but he has a form, a physical form. You believe that God, you're a corporeal God, you're a heretic. That's what the Rambam says. Now look at the Raivad. Let me enlarge this for you. The Raivad, the great Raivad, says as follows. He quotes the Rambam, va'omer sheyesham ribon echad, el shuguf ubal tmuna, one who says that God has a physical form is a heretic. Aleph Aleph, Amar Abraham, Amar Avraham. The Raivat says, V'lama kara lezemin? Why is the Rambam called this person a heretic? V'chama gedolim v'tovim mimenu halchu b'zo ha'machshava. There were greater and better people than the Rambam who followed this opinion. That is, who believed God had a physical, has a physical form. Why they believe this? Based on what they saw in scripture. After all, God walks in the garden. Moses sees the his back, the back of his head. The Yoser, but more what they saw in the Agadot. You have all sorts of anthropomorphic agadot, God wears tefillin, things like that. He's out, all sorts of things. Hamashapshos esadeos, which confuse people. So the Raiva doesn't believe this. He says that these people are confused, but they don't know any better. These are, the Raiva knew that the Rambam was great, and he says that these are very great people, and they were misled by what they saw in the Torah and in Chazal to think God has a physical form. Incidentally, on the spot here, the Migdal Oz. The Migdal Oz is one of the commentaries. He says he can't accept what the Raivad says. That he says that the Gemara tells us that he tells a story where a guy sold his animal to a non-Jew, and the non-Jew had to sell the animal back because the animal wouldn't eat, let's say, food that Trumos and Maestros weren't taken from. And the Gemara derives from this that God watches over even the animals of the righteous. And the Migdal Oz says, if God watches over the animals of the righteous, all the more so, he watches over the righteous. So you can't have, how could there be people greater than the Rambam who thought this? Rav Shem Tov Falakera, who's a medieval philosopher, defender of the Rambam, says that, you know, the Raivad says, gedolim v'tovim imenu, greater and better than the Rambam. He says, maybe they were gedolim, heavier, v'tovim, and better looking than the Rambam, but certainly there weren't any great scholars. But so the Raivat's comment raises a few interesting issues, which for the purposes of these classes, we're not going to get into. I'll just raise them. First of all, who are these gedolim v'tovim imenu? The Raivat had respect for the Rambam, and he's saying people greater than Rambam thought God had a body. The Rambam himself mentions that he met sages who were not sure of whether God has a body, people talmidei chachamim, and then he met some who, it's not that they weren't sure, they were certain he had a body, and anyone who thought differently, they said he's the heretic. And there's many sources you can bring on this, that perhaps even some of the greats of France, of northern France, but we have many reports. It doesn't mean a body necessarily like ours, it could be is the most pure body you can imagine, but a form nonetheless of some sort. And there's nothing explicitly anywhere in the Torah that says there's no physical form, or for that matter in the Talmud explicitly. And if you want to read certain passages, you can read them that way. So this is an old dispute. I don't need to get into the historical dispute. What I'm interested in is that the Rambam says these people are heretics. The Raivad says they're not heretics. They don't know any better. Now, the Raivad, presumably the Raivad didn't even regard this as heresy. But many later people after the Rambam used the Raivad's model. They assume that the Rambam's right. It's heresy to believe God has a physical form. But they adopt the Raivad's perspective that if you don't know any better, what we can call kathira b'shogig, unwitting heresy. So this then becomes, even though, as I said, I don't think the Raivad himself regarded this as heresy. He just regarded it as wrong. A lot of things can be wrong and not be heretical. At least there's no evidence they regarded it as heresy. Many others later did regard it as heresy. And this then creates a big dispute, a kfira b'shogig. If you're an unwitting heretic, you have the Rambam, who clearly says, doesn't matter, a heretic's a heretic, as Reb Chaim Soloveitchik famously said, nebuchanach bikoris is eichanach bikoris. If you're a heretic, because of Nebuch. You don't know any better. You're still a heretic. And this position is held by the Abarbanel, a whole group of authorities down to modern times. On the other hand, the other side, you also have great figures. You have the Tashbetz, Rav Yosef Albo, and down to our day, Rav Cook, even Rav, I believe Rav Moshe Sternbach holds this position, because during the Slifkin controversy, he said that Slifkin's books are heresy. So someone I know who's in his shul said to him, well, what about Slifkin? Is he an apikoros? And Rav Sternbach said, no, he's not an apikoros, but the books are heresy. Well, I don't, you know, what's going on here? If isn't the definition of a heretic one who believes in heresy? But my friend explained it to me that he assumes that Rav Sternbach holds like the Raiva, that if you don't know any better, your view is heresy, but you yourself are not a heretic. Why, incidentally, does Rav the Rambam have this position? He responds seemingly to the Raivad in the Mar Nevuchim. He explains, you know, he responds to at least an opinion that looks like the Raivad's opinion. So Rav Kafach says he must have had the Raivad's criticism. For the Rambam, immortality is natural. It's not a reward. The Meiri refers to it as a tolda. That is, if you live the way you're supposed to and enlarge your intellect the way you should, then when you die, your soul lives on. That's what immortality is. It's not a reward per se given to you by God, so that God, therefore, well, he'll be nice and give you a reward because you don't know any better. It doesn't work that way for the Rambam. It's a natural process. Rabbi Bleich, in the introduction to his book, With Perfect Faith, tries to make this idea palatable of the Rambam. And he compares it to that, I think the way he says is, it's like if you never took algebra, you won't understand calculus. I think those are the words he uses. Therefore, it's not that if we say you can't take calculus, it's not we're punishing you. It's just that you haven't entered that realm. Rav Yosef Albo, the author of the famous work Sefer Yekarim, is the primary defender of the view that a kofer b'shogeg, an unwitting heretic, does not make you a heretic. That is, you're not regarded as a heretic if you believe in heresy unwittingly. According to Rav Yosef Albo, and this is right at the beginning of his book Sefer Yekarim, if you believe that God has a body or anything heretical based on how you misinterpret the Torah or rabbinic texts, you are blameless. And that's the dispute we're speaking about. A recent author, Menachem Kellner, in one of his books asks, well, how far would Yosef Albo take this? Let's say he met someone like Mordechai Kaplan. How far are you going to take this idea of kfir b'shogeg? But really, that's a misunderstanding. Rav Yosef Albo is clear. He's talking about people who believe that their view is the Torah's view, but it's actually a heretical view. Like they say that the Torah teaches that God has a physical form. But they believe that's the Torah's view. He's not referring to people who will say, the Torah says this. I understand the Torah says this, but I reject the Torah and I have a different view. Those are not what Rav Yosef Albo was speaking about. He's speaking about people who believe that their heretical view, they don't think it's heretical, we think it's heretical, is what the Torah teaches. For them, he regards this as a shogeg and they're not regarded as heretics. How far you take this is an interesting question when it comes to Rav Yosef Albo. What about a Jew for Jesus? Someone who actually believes that Jesus is God. I've tried to work it out that he wouldn't go that far. Because if you actually believe, let's say, that a person is God, then you real Avodah Zarah, you don't even have a religion anymore. So it's not like you could say Kfir B'Shogeg, you don't have a religion. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe... I mean, it's a very liberal position in our era of disputes in the Orthodox world, where lots of people like to call the other heretics. If we would adopt this position, which I say is the Tashbetz, it's the Yosef Albo, it's the Radbaz, down to Rav Cook, Chaim Hirsch, and many others, then we wouldn't have any of these disputes because everyone could say, you could look at open Orthodox and you could say, well, I think that you have a heretical idea, but I know you think this is in line with Torah, so you're not a heretic. It would make a lot of sense. It'd help us deal with Chabad. Because everyone can acknowledge that even the extreme messianists believe that this is what the Torah teaches. So you could, even if you want to think it's heresy, I don't think it's heresy because what's heretical about thinking your Rebbe's Mashiach? You could be wrong unless you think Boreinu, you think he's the creator or something. But so it's an interesting position. Now, the question is, how does this all relate to Siman 132 in the book? page 283, because I found something in the Lubavitcher Rebbe that I found astounding, and I wrote to Rav Chaim Rappaport. The Lubavitcher Rebbe says as follows, in a letter to, I don't know who this Rabbi Zimmer is, but I wrote to Rav Chaim Rappaport, of course, the great Chabad scholar. The Rebbe says as follows, that there is a difference between sharp language, curses, and, you know, the harsh stuff you say when it comes to ideas. When you speak about, let's say, a party, there, let's say Mizrahi or anything like that. And when you're dealing with an individual, that is sharp language, like you said, sometimes, like the Briskers, you could say that Mizrahi is heretical, the idea, but the individuals, you don't treat them that way. Okay, so far enough, makes sense. But then the proof, then what the Rebbe says as follows, Dugmala Davar, I'll give you an example, he says. The Rambam Paskins, like we just saw, HaOmer Shehu Guf Ubal Tzmuna HaRezamin. The Rambam says, if you think that God is a physical form, you're a heretic. And then the Rebbe says, Upshita Shalohai Akosev Chas V'Shalom. It's obvious that the Rambam would not say, God forbid, this about Pony Uponi Shabiyamov. He wouldn't say this about an individual. So the Rebbe says that according to the Rambam, if you believe that God has a physical form, you're a heretic. But the Rebbe says, but if there was an individual in the Rambam's day who actually believed and said God has a physical form, the Rambam wouldn't call him a heretic. So I wrote to Rappaport, what do you mean the Rambam call it? That's the whole point of the Rambam. The Rambam says, HaOmer. Notice the Rambam doesn't say you think it, HaChoshev. The Rambam uses the language HaOmer. So the question is this Lav Dafka, or Rav Chaim Hirschman wants to argue that we don't treat people like heretics unless they publicly voice it. That is a private heretic. If someone tells you, for instance, privately his view, he doesn't publicize it, he could still be a member of our community in good standing as long as he doesn't make trouble. What God does with him, that's something else. But he wants to say that the Rambam's language, HaOmer, is actually precise. But certainly, if you get up and publicly say, I'm teaching, I'm going to open a yeshiva tomorrow, and I'm going to teach that God has a physical form, and everyone who comes, I'm going to teach you that. How could the Rambam not say about me that I'm a min, an apikoros? And yet the Rebbe says he wouldn't say that because it's only speaking about ideas, not about individuals. And this, of course, fits in with the whole Chabad, I guess, philosophy. But I wrote to Rabbi Rappaport, what's going on here? And Rabbi Rappaport himself says, this seems very strange at first because the Rambam is very beruri, very clear that you're a heretic. And that's the whole point of the Raivad's response. How could the Rambam call these great rabbis heretics? The answer is they weren't heretics because they didn't know any better. And Rabbi Rappaport says, Itmaha, you know, it's strange. He says, how could you say that the Rambam, lo kiyem ba'atzmo, masha pasuk lachem? How could the Rambam not have held this when he's telling us that all these people think that we have to regard them as heretics? And Rabbi Rappaport explains as follows. He says that the explanation of the matter is, first, he says, let's understand something, that in the Rambam's day, there were many people who thought God had a physical form. And he cites in the note, first of all, the passage I gave from the letter of the Rambam on Tchias HaMetzim and other places, we have the letter of the Ramban. The letter, the Ramban writes to them that I've heard. So we don't know. Maybe the Ramban was misinformed. But he says, I've heard that one of the things you're upset about with the Rambam is that because he says that God has no physical form. And the Ramban says, what are you talking about? We all believe that. But at least he was of the opinion that that's what the scholars of northern France thought. Rabbi Rappaport also cites something else, which it's good you're sitting down. I am the one, I believe, who discovered this passage. When I say discovered, obviously the person who published it knew it, but I'm the first one who wrote about it. Unfortunately, I didn't know about it when I had my book, when I wrote my book on the 13 principles where I would include it. I did mention it in subsequent posts, and I've translated the entire passage. There's going to be a Jubilee volume coming out for Rabbi Moshe Shama of Flatbush. So I have a whole translation and discussion of it. But the Riaz, Rav Yitz Isaiah Trani the Elder, in his commentary on Sanhedrin, says that Hayu Michachmei HaTalmud HaKdoshim Shemehem Tetzei Torah Israel that there were sages of the Talmud, shehivinu hamikraos kipshutam, and what they thought, ki HaKadosh Baruch Hu bal gufu tmuna. The Riaz says that there were even sages in the Talmud who thought this. I know this sounds heretical, but that's what the Riaz says, and this explains a problem. Because how can you have medieval Ashkenazic sages who thought this? What, they just made it up? How would they make it up? Well, the answer is that they had it on a tradition. They must have had this, I believe there were two traditions. And then there were, and the Riaz says it explicitly, that there were those who thought that. So this was a view, which the Rambam was able to uproot, a mistaken view, but people give the Rambam all the credit. That's a mistake. It's not just the Rambam. It's Rav Sadia Gaon also and others. So the Rabbi Rapport begins that you have to understand this was a common view. And the Rambam, of course, he uproots it. He puts in his 13 principles. It's in other places. But then what to do with the Lubavitch Rebbe? Well, before we even get to that, Rabbi Rappaport quotes Rabbi Chanan Wasserman. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman deals with this passage. And he has a problem also with this passage because the Rambam has another place where he deals with Karaites. And he says that when you deal with Karaites, who are heretics, they don't accept the oral law. And because of that, they misinterpret the Torah, because you can't interpret the Torah without the oral tradition. I like to say, maybe to shock people, but it's true, that Judaism is not based on the Torah. It's based on the Torah and the oral Torah. That is, we're not Karaites and we're not Christians. Judaism is not based just on the Torah. You cannot understand the Torah without the Torah Shel Baal Peh, what Jacob Neusner used to call the dual Torah. There's two Torahs, Torah Shel Baal Peh, Torah Shel Bichsav. And anyone who just reads the Torah without the Torah Baal Peh will be violating halacha left and right, as well as all sorts of other problems. But Rav Chanan Wasserman has a problem because he says, the Rambam here says, you're a heretic if you believe God is a physical form. It doesn't matter why. And he quotes Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. He's one of those who quotes him, that a heretic, even if you don't know any better. But then what about the Karaites? The Rambam says with Karaites, even though they're heretics, we have to bring them close with bonds of love because they don't know any better. They've been raised this way. And we have to try to bring them close to traditional Judaism. And the Rambam ends it by saying, don't kill them too fast. Because, you know, if we had based and you kill the heretics, he says, the Karaites, you know, you take, give them a chance. Well, what's going on here? How could the Rambam say, if you think God is a body, you're a heretic, even if you don't know any better? But here the Karaites, they don't know any better. We try to bring them close. And what Rabbi Rapport explains, and I think this is, there's no doubt this is the answer, is, and Revel Soloveitchik says the same thing to Brisker Rav, is that it's not a contradiction at all. When the Rambam deals with the Karaites, in Ogos Mamrim, he's talking about how we relate to them. That since they don't know any better, we try to bring them close. He's not talking about Kapei Shamaya, as far as God's concerned. If they don't know any better, if they're heretics, they're heretics. So in Hilchos Tshuva, when the Rambam says, you think God is a physical form, you're a heretic, that's vis-a-vis God, that you believe a false idea. Yeah, it's not your fault, but that's what Reb Chaim Soloveitchik said. Nebuch HaBikoros is still an Apikoros, but we're going to, if we meet someone who doesn't think God has a body because he's raised that way, we'll try to change his mind. We won't treat him like a heretic until he, is fervent in his belief. It doesn't change. Rabbi Chanan has a different opinion. Actually, Rabbi Chanan develops the idea that when it comes to false ideas about God, it's because people are not really shogeg. They weren't really led astray. Because they want to sin, they convince themselves that of all these heretical things, which is we've spoke about this idea in the classes of Rabbi Chanan. You can go back to the tapes. It's a very hard position. It doesn't take into account a real moral atheist. And furthermore, what about all the other Ikarim, which have nothing to do with God, why would someone deny them? And Rabbi Rapport says the same thing. So then what about how to explain the Lubavitcher Rebbe's position? He says, hold on, so let me move on. Let me skip a few things. All right. So he believes that what the Rebbe is saying is that when the Rambam says, when he says that the Rambam would not call an individual a heretic, that's exactly what he's talking about. If the Rambam met the rabbis of northern France, that's what Rabbi Rappaport says, Chachmei Tzarfat, Sheaminu b'Hagshama, who believed in God's corporeality. I don't know if this is true, that the rabbis of northern France were corporealists. All we have is really the Ramban reporting what was said, and other people attack them. We don't have anything, with one exception, from the rabbis of northern France. We have this very strange text called Ketav Tamim by Moshe Taku, which he's a corporealist. He assumes that God can assume a physical form if he wishes. But the idea that the other sages of northern France, I don't think we have evidence that they believe that. The masses, yes. But the rabbis, I don't know. But whatever, that's what Rabbi Rappaport says, that this is what the Lubavitcher Rebbe is saying. Just like with the Karaites, who don't know any better, we treat them well. We're not talking about their fates, you know, vis-a-vis heaven. So too, the Rambam, when he meets one of these corporealists, he's not going to go up to them and say, you're a heretic. He's not going to call them a heretic. He's going to try to bring them close. He's going to try to educate them. Yes, they are a heretic. But, and this is just like in a Chabad shul, but like any shul. How many people come in? They're complete heretics. They don't believe in anything. They can go to Chabad shul. Guy can eat on Yom Kippur. I was in a Chabad shul once, and this guy, he tells me he's an atheist. He doesn't believe in God, but he likes coming here because the rabbi's so nice, and he gives the rabbi a lot of money. So, were we going to stand up in front of everyone and say this guy's a heretic? Of course not, but he is. So, you know, that's what he's saying the Rebbe intended. But it's not referring to their actual fate, I guess you could say, of their soul or anything like this. It's just that he wouldn't call them publicly. He would heretics. Yeah, they are heretics, but he's not going to go attack them because they don't know any better. That's what. In his last paragraph, he says we have one of the last paragraphs, he says that this approach we see it elsewhere, and he mentions the Satmar Rebbe. And this is what I said as well. He says, if you read the Satmar Rebbe's writings, he attacks everyone who accepts the state of Israel like a kofar, but yet we know that he was friendly with people like the Belzer Rebbe or Aaron Cutler. So Rabbi Rappaport says that so too, he had to distinguish between the belief and the person. I think there's a big difference here though. Because my point, what I say about the Satmar Rebbe is the Satmar Rebbe used this language, but he didn't think Rav Aaron Cutler is a heretic. He said that if you accept the state, it's kfira. But he did think it's kfira, but he didn't think it's Rav Aaron Cutler is a heretic. But the Rambam is different, I think, what the Lubavitcher Rebbe's point is. The Rambam would think that these people are heretics for believing God as a physical form. How could you not? The Rambam says explicitly. But you treat them nicely because you're trying to educate them. That's a difference. And then he, right before he ends his letter to me, he says that I don't need to. He just ends that the Lubavitcher Rebbe held. He cites a letter from the Lubavitcher Rebbe where we see, even leaving this aside, that the Rebbe held like the Raivad. That the Rebbe believed in the idea that a kofar b'shogeg, one who's an unwitting heretic, is not even vis-a-vis heaven, is not regarded as a heretic. And Rabbi Rappaport says that's also the shitas hamakubalim, that in Kabbalah they also teach this. So it's an important idea dispute, which we could spend a couple hours on going through the various sources, but it's valuable to remember. And I think the upshot is that if you follow this position, which they attribute to the Raivad, not sure, because I don't know if the Raivad really thinks we're doing with heresy, but it's certainly Yosef Albo and Natash Bates and others, it opens up all sorts of liberalizing possibilities that you can completely reject people and think their views are even literal heresy, but since they think it's in line with Torah teaching, they are not to be regarded as heretics. Obviously, you don't want to teach people these views, but you can relate to them with dignity as Torah Jews in good standing, count them in the minyan. You don't have to worry about their wine, all the things that you hear people when they want to view someone as michutz l'machana, be them Chabad or left-wing Orthodox, all these things, they use all those examples. But all you do is look at Rav Yosef Albo, and you see otherwise. In fact, Rav Yosef Albo, they give. Actually, I'll get to it because the next responsum also deals with the same issue and the Chasam Sofer. I don't know if we'll at least be able to start it today because we have a few more minutes. So now we finish with 132. I actually think this is a very important letter in setting forth ideas of Hilchos Deos, I guess you can call it. And we have a very similar letter, a related letter, I should say, the next one, from Rabbi Mazuz. We're going to see now 12 straight letters from me and Rabbi Mazuz. When I get to a later letter, I'll tell you more about Rabbi Mazuz, how I connected to him, why I think he's important, why, despite the fact I do not hold of, doesn't mean I share in all his views and philosophical views. No, it's not that at all. Here we are. I never buy 100% into what anyone's going to say. And he doesn't feel you need to, but there, of course, I have my own views and things I think differently of, but I think, as I've said before already, he's one of the most special rabbis in terms of his wide ranging knowledge. I just, over Shabbos, I was reading this book. This is a new book called Ateres Shlomo. It's about Rav Shlomo Gorin. And it's talking about how unusual all the things Rav Gorin knows. And then he says there's two other rabbis in our day who can be compared to Rav Gorin in that respect. And that is, he says, Rabbi Mazuz and Rav Shlomo Fisher from Itri. Each one of them are different. Rav Gorin did have great knowledge, but he didn't have the sort of wide-ranging knowledge we're speaking about. It's a great book, by the way. And Rav Shlomo Fisher, he has enormous knowledge, philosophical knowledge. I showed you his book on his edition of Chasdei Kreskos and others, but he doesn't have, as far as I know, the wide-ranging Parshanut and other things. But so we're going to see many letters. And the first letter, it's the question is, the title of it is, if someone holds a principle of faith in accordance with a view that's rejected, is he to be regarded as a heretic? This goes back to 1992. So before we even get to the letter, let me give you a bit of a summary, a background of this. Whenever we deal with theology, we start with the Rambam. He's the greatest. There's no question about it. When I say he's the greatest, he's the greatest halachist also. It doesn't mean the others are not great, and I don't think it's an insult, but in terms of his influence, and that's going to be important, because I think one of the things I'm going to say is that you can never throw out the Rambam. In my opinion, and not just my opinion, the idea that you can ever say that the Rambam's view is invalid, because other rabbis disagree, that to me is going to be out of bounds, which we wouldn't necessarily say about others. But did the Rambam have a conception of that theological matters can be decided? That is, you can have a debate on theological matters, and if the majority decide one way, the Rambam's position then is void or anything like that. In other words, do you paskin halacha on theological matters like you do on halachic matters? That's the question. And I have a whole article on this I can send anyone, but my claim is that the Rambam did not have this conception, not with regard to dogma, certainly not with regard to dogma, as we'll see, but not with regard to other matters of Jewish thought either. Let me first speak about dogma, because that's what Rav Mazuz is going to deal with, and which I actually do not accept what he says for reasons I'll explain. Can dogmas be decided in a halachic fashion? And it's often claimed that yes, they can. According to the Rambam, and this is very obvious, it's so clear, and no one actually disagrees that the Rambam holds this, I think, but they think others hold it differently. Dogmas are eternal truths, eternal verities. That is, they're eternal because the reality they describe is eternal. If you say that God does not have a physical form, it's not because the rabbis decided God doesn't have a physical form, and had they decided differently, then That would be an acceptable belief. No, this is the theological truth. It was never decided. That's what it is. And if all the rabbis get together tomorrow and decide that God has a physical form, well, these rabbis are all wrong, because God not having a physical form or any other theological truth is an eternal truth. It's not decided by the rabbis. It has always been this way and it will always be this way. And according to the Rambam, your share in the world to come depends on this. So as I said, if the majority of the rabbis get together and decide God has a physical form, it doesn't change anything. On the contrary, you would be obligated to oppose the rabbis. The old paradox we spoke about earlier, you'd be obligated to be a Zaken Mamre. If we have a Sanhedrin and the Sanhedrin declares that we have to believe that God has a physical form, we would still be obligated to say that this Sanhedrin are teaching heresy, and we reject them, and it doesn't matter. We'd have to be executed, I guess, as Zaken Mamre, because it's like I heard from my father once that Abraham Lincoln, at a cabinet meeting, he would ask, take a vote, and, how many ayes, and, you know, the cabinet, 10 people would raise their hand, and the noes, he'd raise his hand, and he'd say, the noes have it, you know. If you're right, you're in the majority. So from the Rambam's perspective, he's always in the majority. The fact that a lot of other people disagree doesn't change anything. I have written, and I have not yet been contradicted, so I assume it's correct, that all the medieval philosophical Rishonim, in fact, perhaps all the Rishonim, were in agreement with the Rambam, that dogmas don't change with time. In other words, none of the Rishonim, no one is able to find one of the medieval writers. I say medieval because we're going to see a more recent writer, and not just more recent, a very important figure, the Chasam Sofer. You can't get much more important than that. But none of the Rishonim, as far as I know, and no one has pointed any out, assume that something that used to be a dogma is no longer so, and what used to not be a dogma now is so. In other words, if it used to be heresy, then it's always heresy. And by the same token, if it wasn't heresy in the past, it can't be heresy now. The only way such changes could happen is if the will of the rabbis determine what's a dogma. So in other words, you can have in this generation, the rabbis determine you must believe this, and the next generation, they determine you must believe that. The opposite. But that means that dogmas are determined by the rabbis. That doesn't make any sense for the Rambam or the medievals. As I said, a dogma is an eternal truth. And it doesn't matter what the rabbis say, then the rabbis are wrong. If this is what in the Rambam's opinion. Incidentally, the position that dogmas change is actually advocated by none other than Saul Berlin in the work Besamim Rosh. Rav Shaul Berlin, in his forgery, Besamim Rosh, puts in to the mouth of, I'm not sure if it's the Rush or an anonymous Rishon there, this idea that every generation dogmas change. In fact, Solomon Schechter wrote a famous article called The Dogmas of Judaism. He cites this. He knows it's written by Saul Berlin, and he cites it as written by Saul Berlin, but he likes it. He says this is how we should think of dogmas, that they change. But this is not a traditional view. What I'm going to end, I'll end with this, is that we see this, that I'm correct, I believe, in how the people argue and disagree with the Rambam. When they want to show that the Rambam's incorrect, that a position is not a dogma, what do? They cite a Tana, they cite an Amora. When Rabbi the Riaz wants to show that the Rambam's wrong, that belief in God's incorporeality is not a dogma, he agrees it's true, but it's not a dogma, meaning you become a heretic. He points to the fact that there are sages in the Talmud who believe this. So therefore, if there's sages in the Talmud, it can't be a doctrine, because we see some sages of the Talmud held this, and they're not heretics. In other words, they never say that, well, it used to be okay for those sages, but now the halacha has been decided that the dogma is this, and therefore it's forbidden. No, they tried to refute the Rambam and say what the Rambam says can't be a doctrine, a dogma, namely that if you disagree, you're a heretic. And what's the proof? The proof is that this great Amora, he held this. And if he held it, and he obviously isn't a heretic, by definition, it can't be a dogma. They never say, well, he could have said it, but we can't because it's now changed. The fact that the Amora said it means that it's not a dogma. We will see next class, however, what Yosef Albo has to say about this and the Chasam Sofer, because the Chasam Sofer actually does adopt the position that dogmas change in opposition to the position I just set out. And then we'll see what Rabbi Mazuz says about this. I'll try to defend my position as well. And then next week, all sorts of good stuff. We're going to move into different areas away from theology. Into some politics, perhaps, as well. It's already 9:31. So let me take the questions and comments. I hope today we raise some interesting issues. David Eisen says, Rabbi Twersky's will specified that mourners recite no eulogies. Instead, he asked they sing a popular melody. That's what we spoke about. The Hoshia Samecha. Barry Hartman says, I have Sfarim by Rabbi Shaya Miller, Talmud of Rav David Soloveitchik and Torah Chagim. Did he write anything about the Rav? When you say, did he write anything about the Rav? I don't do the Rabbi Soloveitchik. They didn't. They it's not like they kept him out of the fold. Rabbi, his brother, Rav David Soloveitchik's brother, Meir Soloveitchik, in the book they published about him a couple of years ago, two big volumes, it's called Meir Inei Chachamim, he says that had Rav Yosha Be'er not become a Tzioni, he would have been the gadol for all of us, because he says that we know that he was greater than all of us. Two grandchildren of the Rav, Rav Meir Twersky and Rav Yitzchak Nissen, were talmidim of David Soloveitchik. Yes, they went to Brisk, because if you're in Israel and you want to know where Brisk is, you go to Brisk, the yeshivas. Yes, we know that. Felix Afarani says, Chacham Avad Yosef allowed not live Kol Isha. Actually, it's more than that. Go back to the earlier classes we had. Well, not live, yes. Well, we spoke about this, that in his in the Abi Omer, he says that you can't, if you recognize the person, you can't listen to it. But then he says explicitly, in he changed his mind. It's in the Yabi Omer, but just in a little place, you won't be able to find it. But in the letter here from his son, he says that he changed his mind, and he said that even watching television, it's okay. So if you want to watch the Mayanot girls and you want to rely on Chacham Avadia, you can watch them if you feel it's appropriate for you. That's the whole point. If years ago, Neshama Karlbach used to perform, and the advertisements for her performances used to say, concert, let's say this, for women and for men for whom it is permitted. What does that mean, for men for whom it is permitted? I'd never heard of this going to yeshiva. So I actually, her posek, now she's reform, she's left it all. But in those days, she followed halacha. Her posek was Rabbi Mordechai Tendler. So I asked him about this. And he said that this is exactly what we saw, that if a man feels he's going to be sexually aroused, he shouldn't go. If not, it's like other areas where it's left. And he claims, I don't know if it's true, but he claims that that's his grandfather's position, Ramosha as well. But these ads would say, for men for whom it's permitted. Baruch says, important point, didn't see them, seemed only females there. No, it's the audience is male and female. Like it's not only that, we even have bands that are boys and girl bands. They combine them. The JC, my alma mater band, is boys and girls, and it's all the high school kids from all the areas and all their parents. This isn't like you have in Beis Yaakov where you have performances and only the mothers come. No, it's everyone there. And Rabbi Kalman says, not done in Toronto in Mother Earth community, as far as I know. Zulzbach fragt gut. I didn't see the question. Oh, there are men. I didn't see it. Oh, yeah. Are there men in the audience? Yes, there are men in the audience. There are men in the audience. Listen, I was in the audience. My son is performing. My son now, who wakes up every morning to do Mishnayos before davening, he also is a performer and he plays the guitar and sings. So, but everyone was there, including the principal of the school. I mean, that's, you don't know who's singing till you go there, by the way. You don't know if it's boys or, but everyone, but all the plays, they always have girls singing joint. In my kid's school, they always have two. You can't have solos, but... The Zemer Festival Hasidi, sponsored by Mizrahi in 90s, had women singing solo. Chief rabbis of Eretz Yisrael used to sit when women in the soldiers, the women would sing, they sat. Now, listen, I'm sure in their mind they were learning Torah and things like that, but they didn't get up. We have pictures of them sitting there when they would sing, because you have a song, let's say, about the a song about Israel or about the Holocaust or something. So again, it's not for me to be halacha. I'm just pointing out for the person who asked me like this far off question about the modern Orthodox girls. And I'm saying, what kind of question is it? The modern Orthodox girls have girls singing in groups. They have from performing. It's not the, Ray singing at Twersky funeral, singing aloud in a cemetery seems problematic. Why would it be problematic to sing in a cemetery? Problematic to say Tehillim in a cemetery, according to Rabbi Kafach and the Rambam, because you're not allowed to learn Torah. It's a lulego rush, but we're not allowed to daven in a cemetery if you read the Rambam carefully, but we don't hold by that. So what will be the problem with singing in the cemetery? You're not having a concert in the cemetery. You're not doing anything like that. Yaakov Yellen says, if he recalls correctly, Professor Twersky quotes a section in his book, Rabbat of Paskia. Yes, he not only quotes it, he goes into great detail, because this is a famous issue between the Rambam and the Ravid, where about Gedolim V'Tovim Imenu. In fact, I don't think there's any question Gedolim V'Tovim Imenu means greater than a Rambam, but the Or Sameach says, what does he mean, Gedolim V'Tovim Imenu? He means there were Gedolim V'Tovim, not greater than him, the Rambam, Gedolim V'Tovim Imenu, greater than us. That is, there are people greater than us who thought God had a physical form. The Or Sameach didn't want to read it as if because the Rav was insulting the Rambam when he says that. Gedolim V'Tovim Imenu. It's hard to, this comes, I think it's a verse in, it's a verse in Tanakh, Gedolim V'Tovim Imenu. So until the Or Sameach, I don't know if anyone had that interpretation that it means Gedolim V'Tovim among us. I think it's clear. The Rambam, the Rav had, jabs the Rambam a few places like that. Someone privately texts me that I may recall Ravad Yosef's Chuvere, Kol Isha and Shabbos, Miros Rabbeim were present, was published in Hamayan. But I mean, we spoke about the Chuvah, and I dealt with it in the classes on Ravad Yosef. I didn't even remember. I'm going to mark that down. I think he says there, close your eyes, don't make a chil Hashem, don't stand up and leave, etc. Wait a minute, the rabbis are not happy. The chief rabbis are not happy to have the girls get up. But the other only option is to get up and walk out. And they thought that that would create ill will. So they would close their eyes, do things like that. Listen, what I just showed you from the girls of Maya note, it's not Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg. Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg's heter is explicit. Two things, that's two parts. Part number one, it has to be trei kali, two songs singing together, which I guess you have. And the other is it has to be holy songs. And that's clearly singing fun or the other music. That's not holy songs. So you can't cite the Sri Deish for this. So you have Ramosha Lichtenstein that it's not going to be arousing. I don't know who says it's. Maybe it will be. If I was running the school, I don't think I would do that. But whatever, you got to give the kids some outlets. And can you have a battle of the bands and say girls are not allowed to perform? It would be hard with these crowds. So I don't know. David says, apropos the question if Slifkin should be considered a heretic, see his latest blog post announcing publication of his book, Rationalism versus Mysticism, his most controversial work. I don't think it's his most controversial work. Sulzbach asked the Shi'ur Koma. Yes, Shi'ur Koma is a text, but what is Shi'ur Koma? The Rambam thought this was some heretical work by these Byzantine types. Shi'ur Koma portrays God in gigantic size. Is that to be taken literally? It's not clear. The rabbi, yes, Rav Uriel Zimmer. That's the rabbi he wrote to. And David gave the link. Anyone could watch there to the delivered, escorted to the grave with the Nigunim he composed. In terms of getting back to Baruch's question, is it appropriate? The only thing I know that would be inappropriate, this is actually stated by Rav Yekusiel Yehuda Greenwald. I know we have one person from Columbus who listens to the classes. He was a Rav for many years in Columbus. He wrote the book Kobo Alavelos, which for many years was the standard work. He attacks the modern Orthodox rabbis. I don't know what the definition of a modern Orthodox rabbi was in his day. He died, I think, in 45. He speaks to them that when they would carry the coffin, the rabbi would stand in front of the coffin, walk in front of it, and recite Tehillim. He says that comes from the Goyim. I'm thinking, though, I've been to funerals. Do we ever have funerals where our rabbis walk in front of the coffin reading Tehillim or something? I think we do. But Rabbi Greenwald, maybe we don't. I can't remember now. But Rabbi Greenwald says that that's an example of taking a non-Jewish practice, chukos agayim, walking in front of the coffin. Yes, I could send you, Barry, I could send you the link if you want about Rameir Soloveitchik. You want me to share the URL of the Mayano clip? I'll share it to you. Let me just show you something. We're having some doubts. I was here. Hold on a second. Let me close up my thing here. Here you go. It's all one group, one room, by the way. This is the first, here. Okay, you can see a man or two there. Take my word for it. They're all, the room is full of men because it's the same. They went right before the boys. They're all together. It's all one group. In fact, if I can, that's the Masifta of Waterbury. If I pull it up here, I can show you quickly the JC. It's a boys and girls group mix. But okay, whatever. I don't need to... it's a co-ed group, co-ed audience. All the parents are there. Actually, since we have just one more minute here, I will, you don't mind holding on one more minute, because not that Baruch doubts me, but I'm going to show you something right now, my friend. I'm going to show you... hold on a second, my alma mater. Here you go. I believe I have it here. Hold on a second. Oops. I think I kept a link for it because I thought I might. Okay, hold on a second. I think I'm going to get you something here, and then we'll end. No, I didn't. I don't see it here. I just want to show you because. Okay, I'll show you next class, the Bruya one. I don't know why I can't see it now, but I don't want to waste your time on that, but take my word for it. Well, you don't need to take my word for it. I'll show it to you. Oh, hold on a second. Maybe I got it here. I'm looking quickly at the. Now I'm seeing all the bands. I don't see the JC band here, but okay. Let's get back to the questions. Let's finish up. Well, the reason the girls sang in the front is because when the girls, it was like a battle of the sexes sort of thing. So when the girls sang, all the girls went to the front. When the boys sang, all the boys went to the front to cheer on. That's the that's how it worked. No boys left from the right wing ones. You know what? Maybe Masifta of Waterbury, they might have left when the girls sang. I don't know. I can tell you. You're trying to find Zachus for the modern Orthodox. I get it. Very nice. The phrase was, these and these are the words of the living God, and I'm sure that some members of Beit Shammai, okay. Hard to believe with the rise of Frumkeit among our circles, and none of this have changed in recent years. Okay, that's an interesting point. And I'll end with this as the last thing. The schools are much more liberal than the shuls. If you look at modern Orthodox high schools, because they pull in from a wide, much wider range. And in fact, you have many people who are not really Shomer Shabbos in some of these schools. The schools are and have always been more liberal than the shuls. The shuls would never have anything like this. In fact, the rabbis, when the rabbis come to events at the schools, and when the teachers are at the events, and let's say you have a play, and then you have the girls singing, two girls, the rabbis get up and the rebbes get up and they walk out. And it's demonstrable when they get up, you see them. And you never would have this at the shuls, but you have it at the schools. And these are all the schools. And Masifta of Waterbury allows their students, maybe they tell the students when the girls sing to leave, but their students participate in this battle of the bands. And that's a quasi-Haredi sort of place. But it's an interesting, and I'll end with this, Baruch, it's an interesting point. There is a real distinction between the camps, the schools, and the shuls. The shuls are much more traditional and are moving much more traditional, that things that would never be allowed at the shuls are allowed in schools. And yes, I'm sure the rebbes tell their students that they should leave. And I'm sure when my son comes back, he's going to be very angry that how he ever, you know what, just I will just show you one more thing and then we'll end with this, because he listens to some of these, just so Shep, show you something here. So you can see the, hold on, the one who is, this, the guy, my son, I'll show you, who now is learning all day, all night. And he had COVID, but I told him that he has to go get his, try to find a place where they'll give him a vaccine. Because at the end of the day, if they have extras in Israel, they'll give it to him. And he says, no, it's Dina de Machusa. You can't go because the government says you can't. I said, it's not, at the end of the day, they'll give it to you. He goes, no, it's Dina de Machusa. Dina, I can't. So this is the Kushner, and my son is the guitar player. Get away from me. So they're not going to win any Grammys or anything. But listen, at the modern Orthodox schools, you got to give them these sort of outlets. They're not most of the kids turn out very, very nicely and everything. You get them play their music, do their things. And my son's a big chazan. You should hear his musaf. And okay, we'll end Dina Machusa Trump's Pikuach Nefesh. That's what I said to my son. I said, they're going to throw it out at the end of the day. Israel has plenty of vaccines. And he said, no. He says, it's Dina Machusa, Dina. I have to wait until the government says, I think as you get older, Dina Machusa, you become a little more cynical on this, because you realize that the government rules are not necessary. I remember we asked Rav Lichtenstein this because when I was in Israel, you had these rules. You weren't allowed to change money. You know, people would go, according to legally, you weren't allowed to. You can only do it in the bank. So people would go to Allenby Street and other places. These Hasidim would change it. But we were mockpit on it at BMT. We're very mamachti. We're very mockpit. And I remember me and my friend, Jeff Kay, were like, Dina de Machusa, Dina, it's usser. This guy from Chevron. Chevron was right near BMT. He came over to change money. And my friend started screaming at him, get out. He's violating Dina de Machusa, Dina. But then we asked Rav Lichtenstein. Rav Lichtenstein said, you know, the government's not mockpit on the small amounts. So he doesn't think it's a problem, you know, changing small amounts. But I get it, because I see my son with the Dina Machusa Dina. I also had it as well. Okay, everyone, thank you all. And actually, Dido Baruch, I don't get this. I get more of the nachas on the Kriyas HaTorah and on the the Musaf. But okay, it's okay to play the guitar also. He leads the kumzitzes. He does all this stuff. There's worse things to do for high schoolers, believe me. Very proud.